have to look at a guy like Marshall and you know, a woman like Jessica, a person like myself or Jerry or Richard or any of those folks, and, or Chris, and ask the question, all right, maybe the union is not a stellar example of what, you know, maybe it's even outlived its purpose. The question is, did it do any harm to Marshall? Did we and the workers actually grow through that whole experience? And would we have grown without it? I think the answer is overwhelmingly no, we wouldn't have grown without it. And I'm not going to, I'm just not going to kick my daddy who helped me grow.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I wish my daddy was something else, but that's, wishes are not going to change. Part of that's a cop out, you know, because that doesn't help new generation farm workers. You know, what are we going to do about that? Now that's the question for the next book. What have we learned that we can do better the next time around?
Mm-hmm.
Or those farm workers that are no longer employed and are moved to a city and are unemployed there, what are we going to do about that? That's the beginning of the next book.
Well, it also may be. I don't know. See, Fred Eister would really like me to include that element in regard specifically to Flock. One of Fred's interests is he wants a book that, in carefully analyzing what has been, can help him and the board decide what should be, because they don't know what should be now, and I don't know what should be now.
That's not your job, man. I mean, that may be your job as a knowledgeable person who has talked to a lot of people, but that's not your job in writing a book, because that would become passé almost overnight. So this is, she's written something that will help us with our strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's your business. I mean, I can tell you, but that's their business
mm-hmm.
to decide what they should be doing. And your business is more to chronicle and tell the truth from a 20-year point of view. If they see something in there that's helpful, good. But
I had set out with this idea that by chronicling what has been, that and really defining out some of the elements, that the church and maybe not just the institutional church, maybe also other movements of dispossessed people might be able to find it useful for another time or another situation.
Have you ever read Barbara Tuchman's books?
No. Cecil, over the summer, read the one, The March of Folly.
Mm-hmm. She's good because what she doesn't mean to preach, but she writes about times that are very relevant to where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote about the 14th century, A Distant Mirror. I couldn't figure out when I was reading, why did she call it a distant mirror? And then I realized she was talking about, well, this is, you know, looking back at this mirror way off, and we can kind of see what's going on to us
mm-hmm.
in the 20th century. Right? She writes about American experience in China and Vinegar Joe Stillwell and all that sort of stuff. And how, if certain decisions had been made, how things would have been different. On how can we learn from the way decisions were made that we will make different choices in the future. You know, she's a liberal who doesn't preach. She just says, this is the way things happen, and if you're smart enough, you'll see what I'm saying. I think that's, you know, I think that makes a book very readable, because it's not like, oh, this woman had an axe to grind, and she's just trying to convince me that the farm workers wasn't with this or that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have to be convinced. If I read the book and there's something there, well, I'll figure it out myself. But it's chronicling the, but it's chronicling the teachable moments of the last 20 years, not just all the crud. it was a teachable moment at the time. That there was a teachable situation around Caesar's past. Did we learn from it? Are we learning from it or not? Well, that's up to you. Here's what happened. Would you do it again this way? I don't know. You decide. There was a crisis of leadership and decision to that non-farm workers would run the union. Maybe that was the important thing to do at that time. Maybe there were no farm workers with them. I'm not judging. Would we do it that way again? Why don't you decide? How was that? It's important, I think, not just to write an essay about that situation, but why did they come to that decision at that point in history, mm-hmm. that they made that decision? Because all, you know, all armchair judgment in retrospect is pretty cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But in retrospect, we can learn from it. We don't have to judge it.
Well, that certainly sounds like a more comfortable thing to do, and I value your suggestion. Maybe I ought to read one or two of her books to just get a better feel for how she does that.
Well, I would say that the one that's most readable and sort of enjoyable, well, The March of Folly is good, except it's kind of, I think she sort of succumbed to wanting to make money,
mm-hmm.
And it's not as. And there are a couple chapters in there that are very good, but I would say that the one on the American experience in China, her best book, where she said she, where when you're through, you said, my gosh, you know, Truman could have sat down with Mao, and Mao was looking for, he was looking for an out. He did not necessarily want to make that deal with Russia, but. We confused what we call the Marxist movement, the nationalist movement, and so now we've had 40 years of estrangement.
And are starting into the same thing all over again.
Yeah. We don't respect people. We don't understand why people can be nationalists. We think we're the only ones that have legitimate reasons for revolution.
What's the name of that particular one?
I think it's called. Stillwell and the American Experience in China. Stillwell was the, Verger Joe Stillwell was the general that worked with Mao and with Chiang Kai-shek during World War II. The other good thing about it, it's just a good book, if you want to just, you know, one of the qualities of leadership that we teach is generalship. How to make good strategic decisions,
mm-hmm.
and it's just a good book, just for from the point of view of how a guy who was stuck out there nowhere made good decisions and followed his gut. He was always sort of unflappable, but inside he was just churning. But he had this sort of serenity about him. Then he'd go home and vomit, you know. Which is a good thing for organizers to read. You're just churning. Your leaders are out there making fools of themselves, and they wish you were. And they, you know, but you left. You're doing pretty well, don't you? Then you do the evaluation. You're supposed to beat them up and get them in another room. Probably a bigger impact in the long range thing, view of things than the farm workers union. Because Alinsky and the IAF changed Catholic moral theology probably more radically than anything that's happened in the 20th century in the United States. There was no such thing as the church engaging in community development or community organizing. For Alinsky. There was trade union organizing, the church believing that, but community organizing, since that they had neighborhood centers, what do you call them, sort of relief centers.
Oh, yeah. Settlement houses.
Settlement houses. But the idea of poor people organizing for power the way unions organized for power was Alinsky's contribution, which then got picked up in the OEO and all kinds of things, but it did not seriously exist before Alinsky. And Caesar used all those tools and weapons that Alinsky developed, the idea of using the Virgin and the idea of organizing a union around the community organizing techniques. And you know, to hear Caesar, you'd think that he fell from the heavens on a half shell, you know, without having ever learned anything from Alinsky. And that's why most of the people in the IAF have absolutely no respect for Caesar, because he will not own up to his roots. And always had that sort of vendetta against Alinsky. But I don't think that's, and I sort of bought that until I started reading some of the history. There's a recent book called The Radical Vision of Saul David Alinsky by David Fink, in which it sort of goes through some of that history of the experimentation that Alinsky did. There's a Charles Curran, who's a Jesuit theologian, writes about Alinsky's impact on Catholic moral theology too. But anyway, I just think that that's important from the point of view of the church too. It would not have been a Caesar Chavez without an Alinsky. And Caesar never wanted to sort of own up that until the time he was in trouble. He brought Alinsky to Delano to bail him out.
Where was that?
That was in a hearing that the California House on American Activities Committee was holding. And they were going to fry Caesar as a commie. And because he had his relationship to Alinsky, Alinsky came in and ate them up alive. Drove them out the door, made them a laughing stock with the press. His opening comment, he was sitting up there, I remember that hearing. And one of those right-wing representatives or senators on the California Senate, it was a state hearing, not a federal hearing, says, Mr. Alinsky, would you just, do you have any opening comments you'd like to make? Well, before I start, nor have I ever been, nor will I ever be, a member of the Communist Party, the Nazi Party, of Ku Klux Klan, or the California Farm Bureau. And that was just the end of it. I mean, after that, there was this.
Was that in the 60s?
That was in 1965, right after the strike started, I think it was. When they were trying to red bait us. Jack Pandel was red baiting all that stuff. And so Caesar brought Alinsky in to testify.
Why do you think Caesar didn't make anything of those roots?
I just think that it's not in the nature of a charismatic leader to feel acknowledged their mother and father, and that's about it. So God, mom, dad, sort of taught everything I know. Workers' rights to one of private property. And his greatest line, one of his greatest lines was, what we found out is that, we didn't find out that 66% of the people of California are against workers. We found out that 33% of them are for the abandonment of private property.
Great line.
Yeah, I mean, that. A guy has been crushed, you know, even going to come up with something. He figured it out and said, you know, we were had. And, you know, then you know, maybe he goes off into this business of using the media, to thinking that the media is the message when it really isn't. He lost the message. And so, yeah, if you don't have the message, the media is nothing. Now, there is a simmering anger toward the Anglo, but I would guess that Caesar in the 60s was too sharp to really be operating off of that. He would use it because that was what the 60s was all about.
Because mm-hmm.
We were playing off the black experience versus the white. And that's where the liberals were coming from. They wanted to feel guilty. And we got a lot of energy from whites who were made to feel guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they'll go out and walk around in circles in front of stores for hours and hours. You know, out of their guilt, not out of their good sense. We used a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I'm talking about, is the church can't operate on that movement sort of stuff, that issue, because that's not the way, that's not where energy is anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The energy, I think, has to be more in collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
But in those years, that's how you got people inspired. It was pretty Freudian. Just kicking where it hurt. It's your fault.
I never used that in organizing church people. And I was aware that that was used, but I never used that.
But Caesar used it all the time.
Hmm.
This is not the farm worker's problem. This is the problem of American society, which has taken away 20 years of life expectancy of these people. You want to give them their life back when you walk around in circles in front of stores. I mean, that's inherent in any kind of movement, I suppose. But what happened was, in Proposition 14, those media experts were able to make everybody else feel guilty about taking away the farmer's right to his private property, and kind of just stole Caesar's technique.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you really believed everything that we put out in propaganda, you would think that slavery still raged. You would never see farm workers who actually owned homes in early markets. His kids went to college, and you would think that 100%, and that's, you know, that's what Dolinsky taught, you know,
mm-hmm.
you've got to personalize everything, you've
mm-hmm.
got to polarize it, you've got to make it start, you've got to make it real. But what happened was, in Proposition 14, they did it to us. They were better at it. They were just really good at it. And we were still playing like, I remember Proposition 14, we thought it had something to do with big rallies and house meetings and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were...
Bumper stickers.
Yeah, bumper
stickers. Remember all the bumper stickers?
Yeah, right. We were just... pulled over.
There must have been a million bumper stickers
right.
put on people's bumpers out
That's
in those
right.
parking
there used
lots.
To be stories in the LA Times about... Well, we don't know who's going to win this election, but we know who's winning the bumper sticker war, right?
But I thought that after that was when Caesar began to move away from the house meeting approach and so on to this other approach.
Well, there's something else that happened, though, and that was that we got into union elections, right?
Oh, of course, that's right.
And
the role of the law.
And there we were running a race. I mean, you don't hold house meetings and run a race at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We were racing with the Teamsters. And you hadn't done the house meetings, if you had won the hearts and minds of the people before that, it was too late. It was a question of getting the right people to vote at the right time and making sure that they marked the ballots right. And, you know, that was just sheer madness for 2 years, or until he ran out of money, I guess a year and a half. I mean, my most vivid experience of all the years of the Farmworkers was living on the floor of a little motel in Calexico and running the Bruce Church election, having 15 organizers with me. The blind, you know, as organizers. Because if you could get out there and walk and talk, well, you're going to be an organizer in this business. And we just lived out there in those fields talking to people. It had nothing to do with organizing. Shepherding everybody to the polling place, making sure that they marked the ballot right. All Fred Ross philosophy and theology and all that was out the window, because it came down. And that's the problem with elections anyway. That's why I hate to be around elections anymore, because it all comes down not to what you've done for the development of people, but how many bodies you've delivered to the polling place. And unfortunately, that's the way our system works. You know, that counts.
Yeah.
But it steals the process. It takes it away.
Yeah, that whole thing with the Nicaraguan elections is an example of how that has been viewed by the administration here. Salvador and the Nicaragua elections has just been a tragic thing.
Yeah, nobody can hold elections like we were doing. By the way, the church had a really good role in dealing with the Teamsters.
You mean the Catholic Church?
The Catholic Church, but also Protestants. I mean, I think if we went back and looked at it, that was where the church was able to demonize the opposition. They demonized it more than they ever did the growers. They really cast a spell on the teachers. They gave them a whammy. I mean, everybody, when they were through, you know, it was like, boogers had gang raped some little 6-year-old girl, you know. There was absolutely no righteousness on the part of the Teamsters. We were through with them.
It did fit nicely, didn't it? Especially for the Protestants who've never been supportive of unions.
Right.
The Teamsters sort of epitomized all the worst that the Protestant Church had always identified in the unions. And then they came in and stole the contracts away with the help of the growers from that little, their little pet union.
Right. And all that works really well as long as your pet union is pure.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's waiting for a guy to make a mistake, like going to the Philippines or something like that.
Yeah.
How could he do it? Boy, that was a raging controversy.
A mess. It was a mess.
Badly handled.
So unfortunate.
Caesar could have simply said, yeah, you know, that was a mistake. I didn't know I'd have not been so darned self-righteous about it.
Yeah, that's what turned a lot of church leaders off. There are people that I talked to who, when they reflected back, they realized that's when they stopped helping.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of them, they hadn't even really examined. It wasn't like it was a conscious choice. Well, I'm going to stop now.
It was when they started saying, oh, well, if he did that, then I can believe some of the things they're saying, some of the other things I'm saying about him.
It could be.
I mean, you could tell me that he's hard to work with and that he red baits even his own organizers. You tell me all that, but I'm not objective proof that he did go and shake hands with these rascals, so I guess I have to believe some of it.
I'd like just to jot down what some of your major assignments were during the years that you were in the union, besides all those administrative chores and typing all those letters.
Well, I was in. That's all I did until I think it was 67. Then I went to Coachella, and I sort of learned the ropes of running a strike, and then in 68 I went back to Coachella and I ran the strike. And then after that, I think I went to New Jersey, and I ran the boycott there. And then I went to Ohio, and I was in Ohio, what was it, in 70 when the contracts were signed?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I was when the grape contracts were signed, and I hung around there for pure export boycotters. Ridiculous thing in lettuce, I don't know what they're doing. And then I drove back to, I was kind of managed the finances of the Salinas strike. I don't remember what I was trying to do, but I was just trying to pull together a lot of loose ends. Then I went back to New York City on the lettuce boycott. New York City. What happened?
You came to LA and for a while in about 74,
yeah.
Wasn't it? Or 70?
Yeah, but I came back from New York City. Moved to La Paz. The time everybody was moving into La Paz. I first lived in that house that Caesar lived in,
mm-hmm.
And I got a trailer. And then I found that was sort of the beginning of my for a while sort of a fall from honor. I don't know why, because I was sort of out of joint. Because guys like Marshall were running the union, and these were guys that were my peers, and now they were ordering me around, and so I was put in charge of the Malcriado distribution, kind of punishment for having somewhere suggested that maybe Anglo should not be running the organization, and then this is off the record, but I remember that's where I. Once I was given something really stupid to Taft-Hartley legislation, and I came back from that, and Caesar. When I came back from that, Caesar was fighting the anti-farm worker legislation in Arizona, and I suggested the recall of the governor. That was my two claims to fame: is the boycott and the recall of the governor. Of Arizona. And he said, that's such a good idea, I'll put you in charge of it. And then he left after his fast, and that's when Vivian and I started living together.
Let's see, what year was that?
Oh, I can't remember all those. It's a blur.
I think I have it. You know, I have a chronology, I have a really good chronology between 62 and 70, mid-74.
Yeah, I'd like to have a copy of that.
I could make you a copy.
I don't remember what.
Yeah, but it's just you have a better memory for dates than anybody else that I've talked to.
Well, I date it by marriages and kids and stuff.
Maybe some of these people just didn't have enough.
That's right.
Enough signposts.
Life was very interesting to me. But anyway, I was in Arizona for 18 months. And at the end of that time, Vivian and I took off for 3 months, and that was my first rest. We went got called back from that to the Proposition 14 then.
Well, what was it you were doing in L.A.?
Well, that was a boycott of Gala Wine.
Oh, okay. Because I know when I was still on staff, you were mm-hmm. heading up one of the campaigns. We were there at 1430.
Yeah. Okay, well, what happened was...
I left in fall of 75.
Came back... What year was Proposition 14?
I think it was 76.
Oh, way up then. Okay, so... 73, there's the great strike in Coachella, and the Teamsters coming in and breaking up everything, okay? And that was the end, so that was 73 in the spring, and that's when I cut loose and took off for 3 months, and everything was going to hell, and I said, like, sorry, I don't have the energy for this, I'm going to leave. And maybe then I went to Europe. So what happens after the Teamsters take all the grape contracts, right, in 73?
Yeah, you want to look at my chronology?
I'm sitting in September, I'm sitting up there in New York on a lake, and I get a call, say, we're going to have a convention, would you like to come back and be on the board? And say, no, thanks. Then I came back. Came back and ran the, I ended up running the LA boycott of Gallo. I don't know how I got there. That was in 70, late 73 and 74. And then, so after the boycott of Gallo, when is the, we were there for almost a year and a half. I remember we were raising all kinds of money. Remember the Fighting for Our Lives?
Mm-hmm.
And we raised $60,000 in one night. Vivian saw that thing on. $100 a plate dinner. And we had all these stars from all over the state. And it was just this beautiful thing that she put together. It was probably the best thing she ever did. So after that, when did the legislature set up
the law.
Just
before I left, I think, or maybe that was 75. Maybe I bet that was 75.
Wouldn't be in there because it's...
Yeah, I haven't seen that. Okay, I think it was 75.
We ended the Gallup boycott. We brought everybody back to work on elections. No.
Mm-hmm.
So we. Okay, so then I went from L.A. to Stockton. I headed up the election campaign in Stockton. I think we ran something like 30 elections real fast there. That's where that Posse Comitatus thing took place.
Mm-hmm. You know,
so after the Stockton campaign, we went from Stockton. I think we went then to, I was in Calexico working on the Bruce Church election. We were trying to win elections down there in the lettuce. And then at the end of that, I kind of broke down. I was sick. It's like for 3 months. It was like getting up at 3 a.m. and going down the Ohio down there at the border and then hauling the buses out. And then work until 12 at night. And when that election was over, then Vivian and I said we're leaving the union and we went to Europe, which culminated in a divorce. The biggest mistake I ever made was having nobody to talk to for 3 months with Vivian. So that. So
when was, what year was that?
Okay, that was.
Oh, that was 78. You said you left the Union. No.
That was before I left the Union.
Okay.
Came back from Europe and went right to work on Proposition 14, 76. And Vivian and I were not getting along. She stayed in New York, and then she came out a little later. And then from there, I went to Lamont. I moved to Lamont, and I was, Scott Washburn and I were holding elections in Lamont, and I bowed out of the election business with the GMR election. Got absolutely smashed. Went from the GMR election to shortly after that, I said, I think I am going to be leaving. That was still 76, and I said, so that was 77 then. And, we ran a lot of elections in Lamont, which terminated in GMR. One son and lost son. And Cesar said, well, why don't you stay another year? And they kind of ran an action on me, and I stayed for one more year and went to I said, well, if I'm going to stay, I'm going to go someplace real nice. And I went to Napa Valley, and I negotiated 6 contracts in a year. And at the end of that period, June of 1978, I left the Union.
So you went there in 77?
Yeah.
Chris's role, what would you identify as some of the important features of Chris's leadership, both in relationship to his own work with the Union and his being able to attract church support? What are some of the things that you think were good, and maybe some of the things that you think maybe didn't work so well?
Well, the best thing about Chris was that he was always, you know, if you needed somebody to take a risk, he could be talked into almost anything, whether it's going to jail or caravans or, I mean, he would drop everything. He's the one guy who was very skilled and very, very conscientious, that you knew if you're in a bind. Chris, you've got to go up and organize these marches that are taking place all over Salinas County, Salinas Valley, and sort of make some sense out of all. Or he would do it, and he'd make some sense out of it. So you just count on him to do the appropriate thing. I don't know what I want to say. The biggest problem, I guess, of Chris and the ministry was that it was prophetic toward the established powers that be. Never prophetic toward the workers. That was it. And when you're only prophetic toward, when you assume that all justice is on the side of the workers, which we all did, Chris and myself, not just Chris, then after a while, I become myopic. You just don't see what's going on in your nose. And I guess that's probably the question, being too close an ally. Maybe that's at some point that's not the role of the church. It has to be over against also.
Get any work done?
We sure did.
I kind of think that I've done over 20 years of organizing, and I assume that there's going to be a circumstance in which I'll want to do something collaborative someday with Caesar or Chris or.
What you guys gonna do?
Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. That's fine. How's it going?
Go down to the Pat changed her.
Oh, okay. You got a later one?
Yeah, 9:05.
Oh, cool.
Okay. 9:07.
What time is it, Rose?
It's Jim.
I have 5.
5:25.
Oh, why don't we rest till around 6?
Okay.
I'm gonna watch it this week. Give the kids
a chance to get a meeting.
You want to be in a position to be able to do that.
Yeah, they're not my enemies at all.
Yeah, of course not.
And I'm not. In fact, I may be their enemies, and I don't know it.
I don't think so.
But if you're at the mercy of the organization, if that's your theology, and that's what you understand, your role is. But then you can't be both at the mercy of and over against at the same time. You can try, but it creates schizophrenia every time.
One of the things I've been real interested to learn about is more about the role of the Catholic bishops and some of the Catholic leadership people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I'm interested in that is because as I sat off there LA in my little cubby holder, I felt pretty critical of that role. And I felt critical of it because it seemed to me like some of the Catholics.
They're gonna stand with kind of the underclass of Latin America. That's where something like 60% of their people are going to be by the year 2000. They're not going to be Italian.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be North American.
They're not going to be Irish.
They're going to be Irish. They're going to be Latino. And so, and then once you say that, well, then you got to make a sort of fundamental decision. Am I talking about standing with the provincial rulers and the patrons, or am I going to stand with little people? And, you know, it's hard for them to make that decision because traditionally they've sided with the patrons.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going through this sort of gut-rending process. And I know these guys that are down there and come back and forth through the valley all the time.
From Latin America.
Yeah, they're priests, like the Oblate Fathers,
mm-hmm.
Who are very strong in the valley. They're priests who are in Latin America feel like the North American Oblate structure is not backing them up enough by taking on Reagan and doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, it's amazing to me to see a conservative guy like Archbishop O'Connor go down there and actually come out of there with as sensible a position he takes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just absolutely runs contrary to who I think he really was maybe 5-10 years ago. That decision being made, John Paul's making those decisions. He's trying very hard to find some alternative position to Marxist liberation theology, but he's not saying that these people should not be liberated. So I think you're right. When you look back at the church in the 60s and the Catholic Church in the early 70s, they were not. The good examples stand out. They were not common.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'd say that the rule would be that you can count on them. They may be mixed up on abortion and maybe some of that stuff. They don't know how to deal with
personal poverty issues.
Yeah, they just haven't figured that one out yet. But on whether we're going to stand with the poor, they're getting pretty clear about it. That's why the pastoral letter is so incredible to me. It's just, these guys have been saying this stuff. They've got to stand up behind us.
Well, as I learn about the church's work in, say, in Central America, well, also not in South America, but I know more about it in Central America, it seems to me like there's more of the style that you're talking about, where people out of the institutional church collaborate with the poor. There's certainly not much space for collaborating with, there's not really a middle class to collaborate with, particularly. But do you see sort of a new and good sort of style for the institutional church coming out of Central America?
I don't know much about Central America. I know Texas, there's a good style. In Texas, we work in 7 of the 11 dioceses, and I would say 7 of the 11 bishops are understanding empowerment and confrontation and conflict, tension, and they're helping us deliver sort of the middle class and upper middle class that normally would not do it, except the bishops are saying, sorry, but you have to. This is what, now if you don't want to be, if you don't want to call yourself a Catholic, okay, fine, you don't have to do this. If you're going to call yourself a Catholic, you got to deal with these people. You got to help. You got to mix it up and get into this new collaborative thing that we're doing here. So that's basically my experience. And that's come after a lot of that is Ed Chambers. He's just poured his life for the last 10 years into getting bishops to move off dead center.
Tell me who he is.
He's my director. He's the national director for that. He took Linsky's place. He was an associate with Linsky's for a number of years. I'm giving you a thing on this whole thing. I call this relationship building itself. I am document. It's in there.
Okay.
It's called Organizing for Family and Congregation. Have you seen that before? It's kind of a very simple outline of how the IAF sees using institutional church structures for empowerment. And the bishops are buying it. I mean, in Texas, they give us $500,000 a year to do this. I get $90,000 over in the valley every year, and then I raise another $65,000 to $70,000 from the Catholic parishes in the valley to match that. So, and the oblates are giving us about $20,000 a year. They're really putting their money into this approach.
You mentioned that Higgins was, that a lot of his work went into that pastoral letter, the economy. I thought that he retired in 80. Did he continue
with that consultant? Really, Bishop Weakland of Milwaukee is the one who pulled it all together, but Higgins you gonna try to see Bill Kircher?
I was thinking about that last night. I was reading that book and about Kircher, and Kircher keeps coming up.
What book is this?
It's a book about
he's just constantly being attacked every day in the newspaper and letters to the editor. He's kind of considered the red efficient as far as the reactionary forces of the valley are concerned.
That's Fitzpatrick?
Fitzpatrick, yeah. He calls himself the midwife of Valley Interfaith. We do a whole day on what we call the difference between public and private relationships. And that you can only hold somebody accountable in a public relationship. The only one you can hold accountable in your private relationships, your kin and your children. That takes place in a that's intimate, and that's not out in the public arena. Now, the problem with politics in the valley is that politicians traditionally have used personal relationships in order to win public office. And you know, it's taken about 3 years for them to accept the fact that we're not going to let them make those deals anymore for the city. Remember me, I'm the one who paved the street in front of your house. I did that for you. I didn't do that for everybody. I did it for you, and I want you and your family to vote for me. Now we say publicly, before you run for office, will you pave the streets of everybody on our street? And don't come to my house offering me a private deal. I still love you. I like you. You can come drink beer with me. But that has nothing to do with politics. That's our friendly relationship. Well, that's a real hard thing to break in a patron system where everything's run on a feudalistic set of relationships. So it means that people who have always been had for a dollar, I'll pay you $40 to get all your family to come out and vote for me. Now they got to give that up. And what do they get in return? Well, the dignity of standing up in a public meeting in front of TV and nailing the guy and say, we want you to do X, Y, and Z. Will you do that? Will you meet with us 30 days after you're elected to see how you're doing? And sometimes, and we've done that with very powerful people, and they found out when it's all said and done, like we did with H. Ross Perot. You know who he is? He's a billionaire in Texas.
P-E-R-O-W?
P-E-R-O-T.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. Wings of Eagles, he spoke about when he tried to get his guys out of Iran. Mm-hmm. Billionaire. We got him down to the valley because he was the chairperson of the Select Committee on Education Reform for Texas. And we told him, we'll work with you publicly to try to pass this education reform bill, if one of the major planks of it is equalization aid, so that our valley schools will get per capita student the same as a Dallas kid gets. And he didn't like it because it's socialism is part of it. He's a right wing Republican. But after that meeting and after meetings in his office, he finally said, yeah, I'll do it. And then we asked him, why are you doing it? He says, well, I've got good friends that ask me the same thing. Why am I willing to transfer capital from Dallas down to your valley? Because I've been thinking it through. He says, I tell my friends, I said, I know you don't like black, and I know you don't like brown, but I do know you like green. And if you don't have to like black or brown, but if you want to keep making your green, you're going to have to educate the folks that are going to run your plants. And that means you're going to have to make a big investment in public education, whether you like it or not. So it's my self-interest to get this to happen, because I want my plant. I need spin it back and around the believe even to see how to make the green. But just to kind of get down to that crass level of that quid pro quo. So, you know, we try to operate on all kinds of levels. And we do it with priests. And we know it's a pain in the ass to have value work in your parish. But it's in, we'll teach stewardship, and we'll get your offering up. Okay? So the deal. And we'll give you 30 new leaders. Okay? Now, return, we want you out front. When the shooting happens, we want you hiding out, we want you out front. And when they come after us on some of these issues, we need you to speak very clearly on this. But the thing about the IF is that it delivers. So if somebody says, I will make that deal, then they tend to get their piece out of it.
Yeah. I've been very impressed with that with the SCOC. Really, our church secretary has been one of our reps. She's a woman who, in my own experience of over 16 years, is best known, in my experience of it, for two things. One, being a very personable and warm human being, and two, being almost totally irresponsible about her job. And she comes out now after having the local training, instructing us all about taking responsibility. You know, if you say that you're going to do this job, this is the woman that, you know, when it was time for her committee to report, was almost never present at the meeting. I thought, this is just fascinating. I mean, this is wonderful. It has spun off a little with her, although it's beginning to fade. I think we need to send her once a year. Yeah, but that whole thing of personal accountability really is, it's a good value and a really helpful value for every kind of organization, people to get imbued with that idea. Well, I would certainly consider going to that training if I don't know how one goes about doing that. I don't want to be sent by my church because I don't want to be a rep for my church. Partly because of the amount of time that it takes, but partly because I don't live in South Central. They just aren't my issues. And so I feel real awkward. From the very beginning, I didn't want to be a rep because I felt really awkward about it. I live in Inglewood. And we've got some similar issues, but they aren't the same, for sure.
No, I don't. If you were interested, I would just, I would approach it, I think, as a journalist or writing this book. I'm interested in I know that there are ideas that the church is wrestling with, and I'm wrestling with those same ideas. I just like to experience the discussion.
Would it be best to talk to his name?
Larry,
yeah. Or I'm going to see John Moyer next week.
Either one.
Actually, I feel a lot more access with John Boyer. I don't even know where Larry lives or anything. I see him at the big gathering.
You want to wake the kids or let them sleep a while?
Well, by the time we get down there, they will have been sleeping for an hour and a half.
I have two grandchildren.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Five and two.
Where do they live?
They live in this area. Do you know where that is? Up on the high desert, up out of San Bernardino.
Who, Whose children? That's yours.
Our son's children. Bruce. These are old. Two of our kids are married, the oldest and the youngest are married, and the middle one told me yesterday that she and her boyfriend are talking about getting married in October. We've been a little surprised that they were so traditional, that they all wanted to get married. To this day, it's kind of astonishing.
I gotta make a phone call.
Oh, I need a call just to show me up, too. Please call me back.